Welcome to the Inform Podcast. This is episode number 34. My name is Neil, and I am here with the cat's meow of the podcasting world. Say hi, Jared.
Hey, Neil, how are you doing?
I'm just okay today. Yesterday I was working, you know, as an analyst slash psychotherapist kind of person. And nowadays, I'd say some of my sessions are done face-to-face, right? Because the office that I sublet is really big. It's very, very easy to sit like well over 6 feet apart from somebody in that office. And there's some people who like to come in and, you know, we've agreed that that's okay with me. It's okay with them. So they'll do that. But then I do a lot of sessions now still through Zoom. So I spend a lot of time, you know, looking at my computer screen. And there's other things that I have to do too, like, you know, answer emails and all that stuff. So yesterday when I was doing this, I started to get a headache kind of middle of the afternoon. And what would happen is like the headache would build the longer I looked at my computer screen. And then I would do like a face-to-face session or I'd, you know, stop looking at my computer screen and it would kind of start to dissipate. But then I'd do more computer sessions and it would go up. At the end of the day, I had 3 sessions by Zoom all in a row. And by the end of that experience, I was just wrecked. My head felt like there was this like vice thing inside my skull trying to expand outward, in particular behind my right eye. And I got really light sensitive. I had to sit for a while before I felt comfortable driving home, and even driving home, like the headlights and stuff from cars and things were, it was a bit much. By the time I got home, I just like immediately, you know, I said hi to my partner, kind of told her what was up. And I went upstairs to our room and I just covered my face with a pillow and just tried to be in the dark and stuff. So I have like this residual headache thing kind of going on today. But other than that, I'm in a pretty good mood. How are you doing?
It's funny that you mentioned that because I'm in a sort of similar state. I get weird headaches that end up behind my eyes frequently anyway. But on the days where I have one day of the week where I see 5 people in a row over Zoom. And on those days, I'm just trashed at the end of it. It's rough. It's a different kind of experience, both like as a performance of therapy and like physically. It's a different experience for me.
You know, that actually would probably be like a fun thing to talk about maybe in a future episode of Inform about what it's like to do, you know, psychoanalysis or psychotherapy face to face, like, you know, 2 people in a room versus doing it through some kind of like technologically mediated fashion. But that's a topic for a different day. Jared, what are we going to talk about today?
Today, we're going to be talking about psychoanalysis, politics, and Discord servers.
All right. Very cool. So let's set this up for people maybe who don't know what this is. So what is a Discord server? You want to kind of describe what a Discord server is and maybe describe the Discord server that you and I both participate in on a regular basis, you know, what it is that drew us to that server itself and what we talk about there.
Yeah, it's basically like a mass communication client sort of thing where several members of interested parties can like create what they call a server. And it's where these interested people will congregate to speak with one another about whatever it is that they've decided they're interested in. So, for instance, I belong to one that's about the NBA. So a bunch of people who are interested in basketball decided, hey, we'd like to talk more about basketball and we're not all going to, you know, hang out together because some of us live in California and some of us live in Turkey. So let's put together a Discord server where we can talk over the internet via text and whatnot. And we can communicate with each other that way. So that's one example. The one that you and I are thinking of in particular for today's episode is actually, it belongs to a podcast that you and I both listen to and have actually both appeared on called Red Library, a political education podcast for today's left. So the couple of guys that started that podcast, and especially the main one, Adam, began this Discord server where people who are interested in talking about not only the show that they do, but interested in talking about leftist politics sort of more generally can come together to talk about in, you know, a myriad of different ways.
Yeah, Discord servers are kind of interesting. I think that originally they were created and they were used mainly by gamers. Mm-hmm. So people would be playing video games together, I guess. I've never used them this way. And, you know, there's a voice chat kind of thing. So you can have a bunch of people on a server talking to each other in real time. And then there's also the ability to send text and images and different things like that through the server. What they remind me of a lot, actually, is, and this is going to be something that, that will perhaps for a very small section of the audience, locate like kind of me, my age and time, so to speak. When I was, my first computer that I ever had that was like mine and not a computer that I shared with the rest of my family was a 286 computer. It had these, it had 2 5-and-a-quarter floppy inch drives. It ran DOS, not even Windows 3.1 DOS. And, I would use that computer to attached to a 2800 baud modem to call BBSs, which were bulletin board systems. And then what happened one day, I discovered this thing called a D-dial. And this was like amazing, right? Because BBSs, you had to call in, you had to post something, you had to leave, and then somebody had to come and read what you posted and then respond to it. And then they had to, you know, it was slow. And a D-dial was an Apple IIe computer that had 6 different phone lines coming into it. So 6 people plus whoever was at the Apple itself, so 7 total, could engage in real-time conversation. And this was like revolutionary. It was amazing. It was so cool. And that was one of the things that was really formative for me because I met a lot of interesting people that way. I met a lot of people who were into cool technology stuff and science fiction stuff and just nerdy stuff in general, which I was really into. And it was awesome, right? Now when I participate in certain Discord servers today, they remind me of those early days of the, not really the internet, I guess, but computers talking to each other through modems and things like that. And it's really a lot of fun to participate in those things. So Red Library has one. You and I both listen to Red Library because it's a really cool podcast. We both mm-hmm. jump onto their Discord server and talk to people there. And the people who are there, you know, kind of have gotten to know us. And sometimes they ask us questions about psychoanalysis. So why don't you maybe pick up the story from here? What kind of prompted us to do an entire episode of Inform in relation to Discord servers and what happens on Discord, this particular Discord server anyways?
Yeah. One of the topics that gets sort of brought up really often, it's the nature of this specific Discord server, is like the formation of a revolutionary politics for the left. And you and I are both very influenced by psychoanalysis, and Adam, who runs the show, is also influenced by psychoanalysis, although he has a lot of other influences as well. I don't know why I'm putting it that way. I wonder sometimes if he views psychoanalysis as like a primary influence or as a secondary influence. I guess that's why I'm being so hesitant about it. But either way, he is also influenced by it. And a lot of the people that come to this Discord server are maybe less influenced by it, or maybe even maybe they're skeptical of it, or maybe flat out disagree with it. So what will happen a lot in this Discord server that we're talking about is you and I will give some sort of opinion on whatever topic it is that we're talking about that is influenced by our take on Lacanian psychoanalysis. And someone will either ask for further clarification on that, or they will ask they'll meet it with more skepticism than curiosity, which is also fine, but it leads to different responses. Like, it's two different ways to handle those two responses that we get on this Discord server that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you bring up Adam, like I would say that Adam, in my opinion, you know, I've hung out with him, you've hung out with him. He seems pretty influenced by psychoanalysis in my perception of him, right? He's very interested in it. He's done a lot of reading around it. We've talked about it for hours and hours and hours. So I think psychoanalysis is something he's down with psychoanalysis. However, I don't think he would call himself a practicing analyst. Right.
Yeah, but maybe that's the distinction that I was trying to draw. So that's a better way of putting it, maybe.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's what we're talking about here, you know, is the clinical practice of psychoanalysis primarily. That's really, I would say, our focus, right? That's a huge focus of our podcast. I'd say it's a huge focus of our professional lives and even our other lives. What I think is really interesting about the conversations that take place on that Discord server and in other areas, right, is that people are asking questions, I think, about the intersectionality of psychoanalysis with other things. Yeah. So they're trying to figure out, like, can psychoanalysis, like, you know, intersect with, or maybe there it can run parallel to, whatever. There's different ways we could describe this. But basically, how can it work with, what does it have to say about things like politics, about society, right? And it's taking it away. The conversations there, I think, oftentimes are taking psychoanalysis out of the consulting room and trying to kind of, like, see what happens when you use psychoanalysis or maybe a psychoanalytic lens or a psychoanalytic worldview as a thing that you interface other things through. And I think that's a really interesting project because my opinion is that psychoanalysis has a whole lot to say about politics. I think it has a whole lot to say about what's going on in the world right now, right? And I think that the psychoanalytic take is a very valuable take. Like, if we were to talk about identity politics, which is something that people are talking about, you know, in psychoanalytic circles, but also a lot outside of psychoanalytic circles, psychoanalysis actually has a ton to say about identity politics, about the enjoyment, the jouissance, you know, that people derive from constructing an imaginary identification and being part of a group and excluding people from that group and including people. It's got tons of stuff to say about all of these different things. And so that's one of the things that I'm really interested in. I would say that this server is one of the places where for me anyways, I get a chance to sort of like think about that in real time with other people. And when they ask questions, make comments, make criticisms, raise concerns, It's really good for me because it helps me kind of articulate, I guess, it doesn't force me to. It's always optional for me to participate or not. But since I choose to participate, it facilitates my articulation of a lot of my own point of view. And I find that to be incredibly helpful.
Yeah, I think of it pretty much the same way, except that I when I write responses on Discord, I tend to not like review them before I send them. So in your notes here, you put a quote for me where I said, you know, I think I totally misrepresented my own position. And I do that pretty often by mistake on platforms like Discord. But what I'm saying, what I think I'm trying to say anyway, is that I think that's good. Like, that's okay. It forces me to examine and then re-examine what I think and why I think it, you know?
That's really interesting that you have, I can see that quote on my computer screen now. And, it strikes me as such a psychoanalyst thing to say, right? Like, psychoanalysts, I don't know if other people would agree with this or not. So this is totally my experience here. I can remember myself prior to really, you know, engaging in psychoanalysis as an analysand, right? Before really going into that and having it, you know, have the effect that it had on me and on my life. And I would say that the overall effect is that I am far less defensive and far less, I would say, concerned about the fact that my thinking about different topics is pretty provisional, right? Mm-hmm. Which means that I'm not done thinking about anything important, really, right? It's a thought process that I am continually engaging in. I'm not finished thinking about politics. I'm not finished thinking about psychoanalysis. I'm not finished about thinking about me. These are all ongoing things. And prior to psychoanalysis, this happened a lot, in particular with political conversations that I was in. I think there was a felt pressure by me, whether this was real or imaginary, to construct some kind of a rock solid argument about politics, about political economy, about Marxism, about anarchism, about whatever it was that I was talking about. I needed to, in a sense, kind of like have my opinion be articulated in a way that was really, really solid and hard for other people to disagree with. And then post-analysis, post-experience as an analysand, I find that, you know, to some degree, sure, I still do that, but it's way reduced. I don't do it to the same extent that I once did. And I'm much more interested in going like, oh, look at that. That opinion seems to have shifted. Huh. I wonder what caused that shift. And that happens all the time, you know? So I think that that's actually kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, I agree. We might have said it on this show before. I can't remember for sure. But I definitely know that you and I have talked about it before. It's a quote from somewhere, maybe Beyond. I can't remember for sure off the top of my head, but it's basically something like, once you think that you have the answer, you stop looking for the answer. And that's less interesting. That's less, to find the answer and believe that you have it. And so you don't have to think about things anymore is, I think, less interesting. I think less, like accurate in quotation marks. Your position is allowed to change. It doesn't have to. You can rethink things. You can be wrong. You can change your position. Like it's okay.
Indeed, right? And this is one of the things that, I mean, this is going to be kind of like what invoking Adam here, he'd say, shots fired.
He would. There'd be air horns in the background noise.
Yeah. One of the things that I think happens a lot right now with revolutionary politics and people who are interested in those sorts of things is that they remind me of the me that I was prior to going into an analysis. I think that there, and this is something that's probably going to make me potentially unpopular with people on the left, but I think that on the left right now, there continues to be way too much jouissance in imaginary identification and in kind of constructing their fortress arguments that they reside within and fire cannonballs out of at counter arguments. And that's something that I think was on my mind when I was engaging in this conversation that we're about to dive into, is that, I found myself as I started to engage, I'm like, I'm going to say things here. I don't know if this is going to ingratiate me to people or not. I don't know if this is going to make people be more interested in psychoanalysis, which is something that I, you know, do want people to become more interested in, or if it's going to turn people off to psychoanalysis, which is something I don't want to do. And that was very much on my mind as I started to get into this stuff, because I think that psychoanalysis, in the way that I understand it, has been a system of thought that has helped me critique myself. And it's helped me critique larger social movements that at one point I thought I had no business critiquing, or that I shouldn't. Maybe I did have business doing it, but I didn't feel like I should, because if I did, that would mean that people wouldn't like me as much. And then, you know, kind of again, post experience with analysis, I'm far less concerned with that, right? I'm more concerned with exploring inconsistency and the ever shifting, morphing nature of the way that I understand the way that the world works, the way that I work, and the way that I work, and the way that it interfaces with the way that the world works, and all that. Anyway, sorry, that's kind of a rambling thing. Do you have anything you wanted to say about that train wreck of a thought that I just put out there?
I did. Well, there was one thing that really stood out to me that I'd like to emphasize really quickly. You said in that stream of consciousness right there, and I think you said it a couple of times so far during our recording, imaginary identification. I would like to make it clear, and this is the way that I think about it. Maybe you would disagree, but I don't think that the identification being imaginary in the sense that we're talking about it means that it isn't important. I think that's a position that I would like to make very clear.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you said that. That's very true. And I mean, maybe one day we'll do a bigger episode on things like the imaginary, the symbolic, and the real. But just for the sake of a quick kind of overview, I guess, of what I mean when I say imaginary identification, we all construct an identity. We all have a fantasy of an identity. We all create what other psychoanalysts might call an ego. And that is something that is a fantasy. It is not real. It is something that makes sense. It's our attempt to make sense of things, but there are things that it can't make sense of. It is inconsistent. We try to make it consistent, but there's always going to be a remainder of inconsistency that we can't really incorporate into our identity, and so on and so forth. So that's really an important thing. But I guess having said that, now we've been talking for about 20 minutes is our weird warm-up introduction thing. Maybe we should dive into some of the things that came up in this Discord conversation that we thought were interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so here's what I have in my notes that I think was important. Early on in the conversation, a couple of people, it wasn't just one, were asking kind of about how psychoanalysis looks at capitalism and the effects of capitalism, the what capitalism has done to people. And later on, there was also conversations about what psychoanalysis might do for, I guess, organizing people ultimately. And there was some comparisons to solution-focused therapy and things like that. And maybe we'll get to those on this episode. Maybe we'll save those for a different one. But let's start with this idea about, you know, the effects of capitalism on our subjectivity and you could say on our psyche, on us as people. What I have here is that I started to talk about Lacan and the way that the time that Lacan lived in. And I made the point that Lacan, you know, when he was alive, he could see the exit from Victorian Europe. I don't think, maybe he even lived a little bit in that time period. I kind of don't think that he did. I think that he was kind of born, or certainly became an active subject after the end of the Victorian era. But he could see the exit. Like Lacan could talk to people who are older than him, who lived through, you know, World War I, who could remember what society was like prior to World War I. He could engage with people who were those old school European aristocrats that really didn't have a place in the world. You know, kind of their time, I think, started to come to an end really significantly and very quickly after World War I. And was definitely done by the end of World War II. But he could look back and see that. And what's interesting about that is that if we divide up time in this way, we can see sort of like the world that Freud was in, that Freud existed in, that he practiced in, that he thought in, that he wrote in. And that was a world that was organized around some very, very powerful and very consistent entities. Things like the church, the state, the family. Those things, I would argue, had much more solidity, much more heft in Freud's era than they did after the end of World War II, and certainly more than they do today, ultimately, right? When Freud was living and working, you know, the Victorian Europe was a pretty repressive society. It told people pretty clearly, there's certain things that you're allowed to do. There's certain things that you're not. If you try to do things that you're not allowed to do, the society, the institutions, the mechanisms of power and control will coerce you to get in line and start behaving the way that you're supposed to. And if you resist too much, then you'll be thrown in jail. You'll be thrown in the workhouse. You'll be thrown in the mental institution, the asylum, right? And that's where you'll be.
You'll be excommunicated from Vienna.
Yeah, totally, right? Like that's one of the things that will happen here. There was really severe consequences, effectively, for not playing along with the expectations of society, right? If you were a man, that meant that you had certain things that you were expected to do. If you were an upper class man, that changed it. If you were like a working class man, there were certain things that were available to the aristocrats that were not available to the working classes, so on and so forth. And this was all decided. And I, like I said, I think the way that I imagine this in my own head is that people, you could ask somebody in Freud's day and age, what do you think the world is going to look like in 10 years? And they could probably tell you with a pretty high level of accuracy what the world would look like in 10 years, in 15 years, maybe even in 20 years, because things were so stable and change was for like major social upheaval, major social change happened incredibly slowly. Because these institutions, because these ideas that maybe Lacan would call master signifiers did have such weight ultimately, right? So that's the way that things were. Lacan saw the exit from that and into a time period when a lot of these very stable structures, these very stable systems of power, control, coercion, etc., started to become less solid and to become a little bit more flimsy, a little bit more liquid. They started to melt, maybe. And he saw, for example, another way I could describe this, right? I think in Freud's day and age, things like the church and things like the state had a lot of power over the market, over the economy, ultimately, right? But they lost that. And in the world that Lacan existed in comparison to the world that Freud existed in, the market was ascending. And things like the state, the church, those things, they were descending in terms of how much power they had. And you started to see the market go from being a vassal of the state and of the church to the market becoming the lord, and the state and the government in whatever form it takes started to become the vassal of the market, the vassal of capitalism, the vassal of the bourgeoisie, maybe. And that's something that he was living through. I think he saw this happening, and he was really interested in the way that this shift kind of like was affecting people and what it was that people suffered from and what it was that they sought help for. So I've talked a lot here. I'm going to pause and let you talk, because I'm sure that you have plenty of awesome things to say that I wouldn't think to say.
I actually don't know what I've got to offer here, honestly. I know that's probably not what you were looking for, but you're on a roll. I don't know that you've left too much out that I have to supplement.
Okay. Well, here, I'll toss you some more stuff, and maybe this will get you going on something, right?
Sure.
And this is one of the things I said in the conversation. I think one of the things that happened as, you know, like capitalism and the market ascended, and things like the church, the state, they descended, is that people went from having what might have been called a name of the father, right? Something that basically told them what they were supposed to do, something that told them how they needed to behave, how they couldn't behave. That went from being a singular thing, a law, in effect, that everybody was expected to follow, to becoming the plural names of the father. It was one way that I kind of tend to think about this is something that was the law got broken up. And instead of having the law, we had a law for this group and a law for that group and a law for this other group over here. So it's taking the name of the father and kind of breaking it up, making it something that isn't singular, making it something which is kind of plural, and taking the law and also kind of like breaking it up in a sense. I think that was one of the effects that Lacan was noticing. And he was saying, I think it's not too much of a leap to say that this is one of the effects that the rise of capitalism kind of had on people. The other thing that I got into is that, you know, capitalism has this sort of, what would I call this? I don't know, ideology, I'm going to say, attached to it. And the ideology was that capitalism is, you know, better than, superior to the way that things used to be. And, you know, old school Europe, that things under the names of the father, plural, is better than they were under the name of the father, singular. Because under the names of the father, there is a market where you can sort of, I guess, shop for the name of the father that works for you, that you're free to select different ways that you want to live, different ways that you want to express yourself, different ways that you want to be in the world. And because you have this freedom, now there's this idea that capitalism would say that we can enjoy ourselves in a way that we couldn't enjoy ourselves previously. And maybe there's some truth in that. Maybe there isn't. That would be a really big discussion to get into. But this is where I kind of started to invoke some Zizek stuff, right? Zizek talks about how the idea that we are more free now is actually an illusion, because capitalism is saying, hey, enjoy yourself. But what Zizek points out, you know, following Lacan, is that enjoy yourself isn't like capitalism, like saying, like, hey, you should do this. It's demanding that we enjoy ourselves. And so what we're starting to see now is that people come into the clinic, you know, seeking help, seeking a mental health professional. And one of the reasons that they come in is that they say, like, hey, I'm not happy. I'm not enjoying myself. Mm-hmm. I have a fear of missing out. These sorts of things are what are bringing people into the clinic. They think they're not enjoying enough. In a sense, what they're experiencing is guilt, maybe even shame, at the fact that they don't enjoy to the extent that they believe that the big O other society expects them to enjoy, right? So that this creates suffering. It's a different kind of suffering than people had in Freud's day, because society is different than it was in Freud's day. What people suffered from then tended to create these very neurotic subjects, obsessives, hysterics. And what we're dealing with now in the ascendant age of capitalism is a subject who is suffering from their inability to comply with the demand that they enjoy themselves all the time.
I appreciate that. So I want to go back and check my understanding of the names of the father. So I'm going to try to outline an example and you tell me if I'm on the right track here. Because this is a newer concept for me. You're talking about it on the Discord server, and now is the only exposure that I've had to this idea so far. So say, 120 years ago, you needed to get some, vegetables. There was like, you would go to a certain and very small number of places that you could go to find vegetables. And chances are they were grown by, a certain small number of people. Whereas now you have the option of going to pick up groceries from a place where they don't use any pesticides, or they only take vegetables from local farmers, or you can go to a large chain grocery store and you can buy produce that's been coming in from maybe all over the world, definitely all over the country. And so you have like these options, these different names, these different stand-ins. Whereas before there were far fewer and maybe only one or two, depending on where you lived, I guess.
Yes, I think that's part of it. Your comment brings two things to mind, right? So the first thing is that there was, in the past, there was times of the year when you could get something, and that was the only time of the year you could get it, right? Like, so there was a season, for example, that you could get apples, and they'd be really good. It was in the fall. You get these really great apples. And, this led to people, in a sense, not being able to enjoy apples all year long like we can today. But the argument is that they actually enjoyed the apple more than we do today because it was limited. The limitation actually enhances the enjoyment that we might derive from a particular experience or a particular object. And we don't have that as much. We're getting less and less of it. Another way to think about this is there's a writer named John Reeves who I really enjoy. He's kind of like, he writes a lot of different things. He writes a lot of cultural commentary that I really like. And a while ago, he was writing about when he was younger, how he would buy an album because he heard a song that he liked on the radio. So he'd get the album. And then he'd get the album back to his house and he'd listen to it. And he discovered that really, other than the song that was on the radio, a lot of the other songs on the album he didn't really care for that much, or he outright disliked them, right? But this was an album and he'd spent the money on it, and so now he had it, and damn it, he was going to listen to the album because he'd spent the money on it, right? And so he's gonna do this. And he said what ended up happening a lot of times, not every time, but a lot of times, is he would listen to the album over and over again and find himself going from disliking it to understanding the album on the album's terms. And appreciating it, understanding it, having a different kind of relationship to the album itself that he doesn't have, in the era of Spotify and Apple Music and other streaming services that are so abundant now, where you have everything available to you all the time. There is no, you're not going to be in that situation where if you find yourself listening to something and it maybe isn't quite exactly what it is that you're looking for, you'll stop listening to it and you'll just find this other thing instead that is exactly what you're looking for. And you could say that that's a greater level of enjoyment, right? That you're experiencing from Spotify or whatever. And his argument is actually, no, it's not. It's not as much enjoyment. And this kind of comes back to the idea of the name of the father from a Lacanian perspective, I think. Lacan theorized that there was this thing, the big O other. And that the big O other, we could say that that's society. That's the world we live in as we understand it. And that it has expectations of us that we behave in a certain way. And that what a lot of people end up doing is trying to conform with what they believe the other desires them to do. They end up trying to mold themselves into what they believe will make the other approve of them, make the other happy. And then taking this out of society and putting it in much more micro terms, you could say that the original big O other is the mother of a child, and that a child attempts to become the sort of child that will make its mother happy. It's the thing that it desires to be is what it believes it its mother desires it to be. Mm. Right? And that the same thing happens on a much more like macro level. We try to turn ourselves into the sort of person that we think the big O other wants us to be, ultimately. So if we're like a left-wing revolutionary political kind of person, we have a version of the big O other that is, I guess, Marxism or revolutionary politics, or if you're an anarchist, I guess it's anarchism. If you're a Republican, it's conservatism. And that people all over are trying to craft themselves into a configuration that they believe, unconsciously usually, will get them the approval that they want, and then they'll enjoy that approval, they think. The name of the father, theoretically, is the thing that comes in between the person and the desire of the other. It comes in between the infant and the mother, the child and the mother, and says no. Yeah, that's what it does. It says no. And by saying no and separating, cutting the relationship, cutting the tie between these two things, it forces the subject to figure out what kind of subject it desires to be, in a sense, and then do that. And so this is an interesting thing, because what you see in it, it's paradoxical. It's the name of the father imposes a limit, and by imposing that limit, it actually ends up paradoxically freeing the subject to form in a way that it couldn't without the limit.
I don't know whether that answered my question about if I was on the right track. So let me take it in a slightly different direction then, because I could be wrong. So let me try.
I'm sorry that I just rambled at you and didn't answer your question.
No, it's all good. It's all good. I just really want to make sure that I get what we're talking about, because it sounds a lot like part of what we're critiquing, maybe not the whole thing, but part of what we're critiquing here is not necessarily the rise of just capitalism by itself, but also the in tandem rise with like the globalization of capitalism, where we can be more influenced by, like in the United States right now, you can be more influenced by what's going on in Canada and Guatemala and Italy and Australia than you could maybe 115 years ago.
I don't know if I follow where you're going with that.
So I don't remember. Ah, man, I wish I could remember exactly what you said that made me think of that. But well, then maybe that's a thought that I'll just have to leave to the side for now. And maybe the thread of that will come back to me. So then let's move on from that point, because I honestly don't remember what it was you said that made me think of that. But I definitely know that it came to mind.
Well, maybe what you're getting at here, you keep on talking about how capitalism has created, I suppose, more options for people in terms of consumption.
Yeah, I mean, sort of phantasmatically, but yeah.
But also in like actuality, right?
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
for
sure. You're not wrong to say that one of the effects of capitalism is that, you know, I can buy bananas that don't grow in Illinois and won't grow in Illinois, really. I can get them anytime I want, right? So I actually have the option of having bananas. I think that maybe the argument I'm trying to make here is that capitalism is the other, the big O other. And that what I think, and this is me attempting to say what I think Lacan was getting at here, or at least it's my reading of it, which could be right, it could be wrong, it could be somewhere in the middle. But I think what Lacan was noticing is that people felt like, okay, if I'm a subject within a capitalist system, I have all these options. That means that I need to find like the thing that makes me really happy and then get it and be really happy. Right? That's what I'm supposed to do. That's my reason for being in the world, is to consume and be happy because I consume. Because that's what the other wants me to do. Mm-hmm. I think something like psychoanalysis could be argued to function as sort of a name of the father, to come in and say, no, you're not supposed to do that. There's other things that can do it too. Psychoanalysis certainly is not the only thing that would fulfill this function of one of the plural names of the father now. But most people come in for help, and what they're experiencing is not that they can't enjoy, it's that there's too much enjoyment. Mm-hmm. they experience a crisis of enjoyment because there's so much. And even though there's so much on offer, they still can't find the thing that they desire. Right. And so then they feel like they're doing something wrong. They feel guilty because they're not living up to what they think the other desires them to do, to enjoy. Right. The enjoy went from being an option. Maybe, you know, there's something that you can enjoy at certain times, to being a demand that you must always be enjoying yourself. And because of that demand that capitalism makes of people, it's like, by demanding that people enjoy, people sort of can't actually enjoy anything because it's a demand now, right? And demand is not something that you can't have demand and desire kind of in the same space, I guess. There's desire or there is demand. They have a relationship with each other. Mm-hmm. But demand is not desire, and desire is not demand. And so that's one of the things that I think is happening here. And that was one of the things that, I don't know if this makes it any clearer to you or to the other folks on the Discord server who are asking about this, you know, sort of the effect of capitalism and that it's had on people, on all people, right? Whether you're a worker, the bourgeoisie, whether you are a student, you know what I mean, who doesn't have a lot of money in your bank account, or you're somebody who is a hedge fund manager with loads of money in your bank account, that this is something that we're all, in a sense, kind of like suffering from, is this crisis of enjoyment created by the ascendance of capitalism and the ascendance that of the demand that we enjoy all the time.
Right. Okay. So then let me try and formulate it so that I can make sure that I understand it, and maybe somebody else who's also slightly lost can figure it out. I think I've got it. So I think what you're saying is that one of the effects of capitalism is that it disguises demand as if it were desire.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure that you and I were on the same page. So it's demand to enjoy it's like wearing this costume of being an object of desire. Like, the number of choices that you have is, on the surface, it's presented as like it's wearing the costume of being desirable, whereas under the costume, under the disguise, is a demand to enjoy.
Right. So this is actually, I mean, Todd McGowan writes about this and talks about this a lot, or at least I think he does. The idea that desire is predicated on lack, right? Mm-hmm. You have to not have a thing, not have an experience, not have an understanding. And that lack of whatever is the thing that then gives birth to the desire to get the thing, to have the experience, to understand the concept. But the lack has to be, it's structurally part of desire. You mm-hmm. cannot have desire without lack. Capitalism is something that comes in and it tries to alleviate lack. And is actually pretty effective at doing so in certain instances, right? It does make, so there used to be a lack of apples throughout a good portion of the year. Now there's not, right? Mm-hmm. That lack has disappeared. Therefore, the desire for apples, it continues to exist. I mean, there's sometimes where you might still want an apple, like not apple season. And sure, you actually do want the apple, but there's something different about that than there was with not being able to have it previously, right? It changes the structure of the ways in which you can enjoy life ultimately, right? And I mean, sometimes people have told me, I've talked about this with other people besides you, and one of the examples that comes up a lot is the pumpkin spice latte from Starbucks, which is only available like at a certain time of year, and people like really sometimes, some people anyways, really enjoy that thing. They're like, oh, pumpkin spice lattes are back, this is great. And that's actually really interesting. And whenever that comes up, I say, but that's not an actual, that's a manufactured lack. That's capitalism actually figuring out, in a sense, the power of lack and kind of using it, right? But it's not really, Starbucks could make pumpkin spice lattes in July if they wanted to. And maybe one day they will. Maybe they'll be like, oh, it's pumpkin spice latte in July day, right? They can easily do that. In the past, we didn't have this even as an option. Lack was really lack. The guy who I was talking about with the album, right? He lacked a certain amount of musical listening options, right? He had to slowly over time cobble together a record collection, and he had the radio, You know, so he had the radio, he had the record collection. He was limited, but that limitation actually changed the way in which he enjoyed music. And I think part of the things that he's talking about is that he enjoyed music more prior to the time when he didn't lack access to all the music in the world all the time.
I'm going to put an opinion out there that is mine, and maybe you don't share it. So if you don't share it, then you can feel free to distance yourself from it. You'll stab me? Okay. Well, yeah. Good luck. We're on the opposite sides of two screens, Neil.
Stab you with my mind knife.
Ah, shit. I'm screwed. what you just said makes me think of this this thought that I've had before, which is that, you know, you and I are here critiquing capitalism and its effect on capitalist subjects. But I think it's important to keep in mind that in its haste to fill in lack, it's also done things that maybe wouldn't have happened, or maybe would have happened much more slowly under other organizational systems of economics. I mean, the fact that you don't have to take a horse from New York to California is probably, I would say, a good thing. The fact that medicine is more widely available now than it was 100 years ago is, I would say, probably a good thing. And not that those things couldn't or wouldn't have developed under any other system besides capitalism. I think it's distinctly important to recognize that its haste to fill in lack allows capitalism to develop certain things that have done, that have had beneficial effects.
Absolutely. I don't disagree with you at all on that. I think that this is actually what you're saying is a Marxist position, I believe. Marx didn't think that we should go from feudalism to socialism to communism. There's a period of capitalism in here, right? He talked about like this historical analysis, and some people think his historical analysis was like completely wrong. Other people think that it was partially wrong. And other people think that it was right. It just hasn't happened in the time frame that he expected that it would ultimately, right? But it was fundamentally correct. But Marx does say that capitalism is incredibly good at certain things. It's really good at building infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And when it builds the infrastructure, what ends up happening now is you can take things that people need and get people the things that they need. And you can do it without expending a lot of energy and time getting it there. And that's not bad. That's great. The problem is that then that infrastructure is owned as private property,
right?
According to Marxism, I think here. And because it's owned as private property, it can't be used to its fullest potential to deliver the things that people need ultimately, right? I mean, as you're saying this, this kind of puts two different interesting thoughts into my mind. One thought is the differences between need and demand. And this is an important thing in Lacanian psychoanalysis anyways. So Lacan would say, I think, that we all have needs. And this is one of the reasons why we do things like talk and write. Those are attempts to articulate to some degree what it is that we need. Now, sometimes we can do it in a very straightforward way. Like if I'm starving, I will say, please give me food. But there's other things that we need. I need to be understood by somebody. I need to be in a relationship with somebody and have them really cherish me, right? These aren't needs that people have, but we always lack the ability to truly articulate that need completely. But we can demand certain things, but our demand is always only part of what we need ultimately, right? And Lacan's really interested in that. That might even be the differences between need and demand could be a thing we could explore more. The other thing that you brought up, and I think that this is what you were saying is really good, because it shows something really cool about psychoanalysis theoretically. So in psychoanalysis, there's this idea, you know, that people can have, Freud said, I'll take you from being miserable and make you just ordinarily unhappy. That's what he said was one of the effects of psychoanalysis, which some people think that's actually a pretty low bar. I think it's actually very hard to do that. And it's a pretty high bar, but that's my thought. Lacan talked about transitioning people from having a symptom that they suffer from to a synthome. And the synthome has been described in a lot of different ways. One of the ways it's been described is it changes your relationship with your symptom. And in changing that relationship, you still suffer from it a little bit, but in a sense you learn to kind of like enjoy the suffering. Mm-hmm. There's something about the suffering which is simultaneously satisfactory, right? And so the way that I think about this myself is that, you know, everybody has in their psyche a symptom which has been constructed over time. And through psychoanalysis, one of the things that can happen is you can dismantle, you can kind of like blow up, tear down that symptom, but the space that it occupied remains. It's not like it just evaporates into thin air. It's taking something which is a building and imagine it kind of falling down. And then or maybe it's stripped down to its very foundation. So the foundation of your symptom will always, always, always be a part of your life no matter what. But what you do with that foundation, kind of like what you put on top of it, might be different. So if we look at this with lack, right, I think that lack might have been seen as a symptom. People experienced lack and it made them sad, it made them upset. And then if they went through something like psychoanalysis, and there's probably other things that people could go through that would have a similar effect, but they might actually reorient their whole relationship to lack. I think that's part of what Todd McGowan's big project is, you know, with the Lack Conference and a lot of the speaking and writing that he does on lack, right? It's trying to get people, in a sense, maybe to have a form of an epiphany where they start to see that lacking is something that is the thing that allows for them to enjoy, period. Right? So it's not that you want to do away with lack. It's just that you want to have, I guess, a different experience of it. Mm. Ultimately, right? You're not getting rid of it. That's what capitalism offers, I think. Capitalism can get rid of all the lack. There will be no lack, which is a lie. But I think that's kind of how it gets sort of sold or presented. And that would be terrible. You know, Lacan said, the only time that we stop lacking and stop desiring is when we're dead or before we're born, I guess. But both of those options are kind of not a great option, right? We don't want to be at the place before we were born. We don't want to be at the place where we go after we die. I don't. Maybe some people want to get there. But I don't want to get there because life is awesome. But to live is to be lacking and to be desiring and to want things, to want experiences, to want understandings that you don't have. And then you get to live and maybe you get some of it and maybe you don't. But that's what life is the process of engaging your lack, you know, in an interesting way for you. Now, I think that and this is something that comes up a lot in my discussions with social workers. I'll say this and people will be like, you're valorizing lack. You know, what about the poor people who, you know, don't have enough to eat and lack any form of adequate medical care? That's not what I'm talking about. I think those are, I could see why they say that. And I think that that's a legitimate criticism. You know, I don't think that we should fetishize lack and turn it into this thing, which is actually like super virtuous and awesome all the time in all forms, because I think that that's incorrect. But what I think we should also not do is demonize lack in every instance, right? Lack is something that we might be able to engage differently than we do now. And if we engage it differently, what happens is we could go from experiencing the demand of capitalism to enjoy ourselves, to be not lacking. And we could go, no capitalism. I choose to be lacking. I choose to not have. I choose to not be wall-to-wall awesome all the time and putting pictures of my wall-to-wall awesome life on Instagram for other people who have wall-to-wall awesome lives to enjoy. Right? I will be a more authentic, lacking, sometimes suffering subject. And I'll actually enjoy that more than being the kind of subject who has it all, ultimately. I don't know if this is even making any sense outside of my brain. I sure hope that it is.
It absolutely is. It makes perfect sense to me. I can't speak for anybody listening to this, but it definitely makes perfect sense to me. I think it's maybe a way to put it is that lack neither is good nor bad. Lack is, right? I don't know if that maybe that doesn't make sense. Maybe that makes it even more unclear to anybody who already didn't like grab it or whatever. But as you were saying, like being homeless and not being able to eat is not a good thing. And
Yeah, I'm not saying like we should all have that.
Right. And saying to somebody, like, if you and I were in the clinic and somebody who came to us was homeless and couldn't eat, we wouldn't say, like, look, you're doing so well. Look at how much you lack. That's amazing. Like, lack, it's not a good or a bad thing, but it simply is. And once you've gotten to a certain point of things that you don't lack, like once you have a certain safe place where you can put your head down at night and eat your food during the day, like once you've met that threshold, then you can have a new relationship with lack that can maybe be more productive than it was before. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the point I think I'm trying to make is that lack is structurally part of the subjective experience of humans, right? It's part of what we might call the human condition. It's not going anywhere. It's part of who we are. Mm-hmm. Capitalism, it does a lot of things. One thing that it does, I think, and you said this, I think, early on, is it attempts to sort of like cover over that. And it does so by being like, hey, I'm going to make a demand, but I'm going to try to trick people into thinking the demand to be happy all the time and be so happy that you're just consuming more and more stuff, right? That's your desire.
Yeah.
When in fact, our desire is to not do that. And we've lost touch with this, maybe. I think you and I didn't exist at a time. We can't see the exit from the Victorian era at all, right? That's so far in the past for us. But I think that to some degree, we and maybe other like-minded people have a sense of the fact that we don't want to comply with the demand of capitalism to be enjoying ourselves constantly. And we don't, I think, feel the same kind of pressure maybe that some other people do we don't have that FOMO, that fear of missing out. Of course we're missing out. I'm missing out on something right now because I'm talking to you. I'm not doing something else. That's fine, right? Maybe I would have enjoyed the other thing more. It's totally possible, but that's not what I did. I did this. And, you know, of course I have versions of my life in my head that when I look at them, I'm like, they're so much more awesome than what I currently have, because everybody has that, I think. Right? It's just kind of what we are, but that's okay. I think that one of the things that psychoanalysis offers is perhaps what I might call an antidote. That was a weird slip. Antidote to capitalism is the idea that you can enjoy your lack of enjoyment. And that's a weird thing to wrap one's head around, but I think that that's a really important thing that psychoanalysis does. I think this is one of the things that makes it perhaps revolutionary, that makes it one of the most interesting sort of things that capitalism has, and not that it's impossible, but I think that capitalism has a harder time kind of like incorporating psychoanalysis into it in ways that it has been able to incorporate so many other psychotherapies into it, because those other psychotherapies buy into this capitalist fantasy of let's give you what you want so that you can enjoy yourself more all the time, right? Where psychoanalysis is like, yeah, you're going to not enjoy yourself, but isn't that great?
It's funny. That's how I end most of my own sessions with my analysts, are like, man, that really sucked, but I love how much it sucked.
It's weird, but yeah, that's the way it works. Anyways, yeah. Man, we've been talking for a while and we didn't even touch, I think, on so many of the things that we planned to, which happens every time we talk.
It does.
But that's okay. I feel like we have some good stuff here. And maybe we'll touch on some of this other stuff later. So what I wanted to do, though, just real, 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 real fast, is say to people, you know, Jared and I were talking about how much we enjoy engaging on the Discord servers for the Regrettable Century and for Red Library. It's really fun for us. It's one of the things that I wish I could do more of, but I time is not something I have as much of as I'd like. You know, but because I have patients and I have teaching and I have a small person who requires me to do so many things for him to stay alive. But be that as it may, we kicked around the idea of creating a Discord server for Inform. And so that's something that might come in the future. And if it does, we hope that we will see you there. If you're interested in that, I'll put an email in the show notes for this particular episode, which you can get to by going to theinform.org. And if you go there, you'll see the show notes, and somewhere in there, there'll be a link to an email. You can email us and let us know what you think about the possibility of a Discord server. So that's my final thought. Jared, you got anything you want to toss out before we wrap for today?
Enjoy your lack as long as it's a good amount of lack.
Perfect. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.